It's October the 18th. We continue in Parshas Miketz, and we are on page 228 at the bottom, Pasuk Mem Zayin, verse 47. We just finished reading how Yosef was appointed viceroy and how he took over the entire system. He was made in charge of the system of storing all the produce in the years of plenty. He was given Asnas as a wife. And now, the very last words in the previous pasuk, in Mem Vav, in 46, is Vayavar b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. He went across the entire land of Egypt. He's now in charge. He's now going to put into practice his ideas. So now we get a very short description of what happened. So the pasuk tells us, Mem Zayin, Vatas ha'aretz b'sheva shnei ha'sava likmatzim. And the land was made in the 7 years of famine to kimatzim, into kmatzim. So they translated in English as handfuls. The word kmatzim, kometz, means a handful. A kometz means a handful. However, it can also mean silos. So the way to understand this is they made many silos, but the silos became full handful by handful. It's a little bit at a time, but a lot of people bringing a little bit at a time gradually filled up these silos over the course of 7 years. The silos became fuller and fuller. You would imagine that the entire structure of the land had to change. They had to build silos. Here you have to store 7 years worth of food. That's going to take a lot of space. So new silos had to be new construction, building silos in order to house all of the handfuls that are being brought in. Vayikbots es kol ochel sheva shanim, and he gathered all the food of 7 years, asher hayu be'eretz Mitzrayim, that were in the land of Egypt. Vayitein ochel be'arim, and he put the food in the cities. In other words, the cities around which the food was grown, the food stayed local. It didn't go to a central processing place. Rather, each area had a city, and that city had the silos for the surrounding area's food. Ochel sedei ha'ir asher sivivo seha, the food of the fields of the city that were around it, nasad besocha, were put into that particular city's silos. So it was a local thing. It was each area had their own silos gathering the food around their areas.
I was imagining only grain, because that's the only thing that can be stored properly for such a long time. But in the notes it said food also. How was that?
It doesn't tell you which food. It just says food. That's all. All the pasuk says is food. So I can't tell you which food. Whatever was grown. I imagine you can store grain. You can store legumes. No, I don't know what else can be stored. But whatever was able to be stored was stored. Now the Gemara tells us that this phrase, "Ochel sedei ha'ir," the food of the fields of the city, asher svivoseha, that were around it, nasan b'socha, were put into it, is to tell us that Yosef here used a method of the science of agriculture, which I cannot tell you anything about, but other than what it says over here. But the Gemara says that he, in order to preserve the produce, he took not only the produce itself, but he took some dirt that the produce was grown in and mixed it with the produce. Not any dirt, but particularly the dirt that it was grown in. And apparently, that helps to preserve what is being stored. Again, I cannot tell you whether that would work today or not, but that is what Chazal tells he did. Vayitzbor Yosef bar, and Yosef gathered food, kechol hayam, like the sand of the sea, harbe ma'od, very much. There was a lot of food that was gathered. Ad, now here's a very important phrase. Ad ki chadal lispor, until it was stopped to be counted, it was no longer counted, ki ein mispar, for there is no number. This verse, this pasuk, this phrase, it was not counted anymore, for there is no number. This bothered me for years and years and years. Ever since I was when I first started to notice psukim, this phrase bothered me. Because what does that mean? There's no number. There's always a number. Just keep adding zeros. There's a number. Just keep going. So what does it mean that they stopped counting for there is no number? How can you run out of numbers?
That indicates it's a surplus of food.
Definitely a surplus.
Yeah.
But why no number?
But why is there no number to count it?
Why wasting time counting the food when you have to gather it?
Okay, so what you're saying is that it's not that there was no number, it's that it was a pointless endeavor.
Yeah, it says it's like the sand.
Right.
You could count the sand, just that can't really.
Why spending the time?
Okay.
It says somewhere, I can't find it, that after he had gotten the amount that he needed, he stopped counting because there was so much extra.
But what the pasuk says is there's no number.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
More than a lifetime.
Okay. You're saying there's no practical number.
Right.
No.
Okay. So there's
surplus.
Okay. So the way I understand it is, and there's another explanation, but I'll tell you how I understand it first. The way I understand it is that you can have numbers for anything. But at a certain point, the number becomes meaningless. As you can talk about, people like to talk about money. You can talk about $1 billion. You can talk about $1 trillion debt. You can talk about what's past a trillion. Who knows?
Wait until tomorrow. We're having the
trillion one.
It's called astrobasis.
Right. As my children say, Google. Right. You can keep on going. But at a certain point, the numbers become so high that they don't mean anything. They're irrelevant. It doesn't just because you can just keep talking and talking and talking, but it doesn't mean anything. How many stars are there in the galaxy? How many stars are there in the universe? There's billions upon billions upon trillions of stars. It doesn't mean anything anymore. It's too big to wrap your mind around it. So you can call it a number, but there's no difference between calling it a trillion or calling it a Google. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't in the human mind. It doesn't have any comprehension and no meaning. So there's no practical number. Yes, there's a theoretical number you can attach to it, but it's not going to mean anything to anybody. So there's no point in counting once you get past that point, once you get past the point of practicality. That's why these exercises that they do, you know, they want to remember the 6 million. So what was that thing with the paper clips, right? What's the idea of that? Because you can't put your mind around that many people. It's too many people to think about to have lost. You can talk about individuals. People can think about individuals. When you talk about it just loses its meaning. So here, that's what the Torah is saying. That's the way I understand what it's saying. That there was no practical number to use. There was so much food that was gathered. There's no practical number to use. That's, to me, the easiest way to understand this. I did see another explanation, which I thought was fascinating, which is mentioned by the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh writes that the system was that each person would give, we're going to see later, we won't see this until we get to the end of Parashas Vayigash. It's going to be a while. But basically, they had to give 20%. They had to give, did we mention it before? Let me just take a quick look. They had to give 20% of what grew, they had to give to the state, to put it away. That was, we did have it before. I will show you where. We had, if you go back to page 226, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 34. It says, this is Yosef's advice to Paro. It says, Ya'aseh Paro, Paro should do, V'yafkeid pekidim al ha'aretz, he should appoint people to be in charge of the land. V'chimesh es eretz Mitzrayim, and he should, not tithe, but fifth. Whatever the equal word is with a fifth. 20%, the land of Egypt. Now, the word v'chimesh, the way they translate it here is what?
Prepare.
Prepare, which chimesh could mean to prepare, but the word chimesh is also chamesh, five, to take a fifth of the land. And that was the system that everybody had to give a fifth of what they grew to the silos for the years of famine. That's v'chimesh. So the system was that you gave 20%. So in the beginning, what people would do is they would, they would start. People would in those days especially, food is money. I mean, it was an agricultural society, so you don't just, take a bunch off of your thing. You count it out. So I have here, 5,000 bushels of grain. So I'll take off 1,000 bushels and give it to the state. And that's what happened in the beginning. People started bringing in, and they would say, okay, here's my 1,000 bushels. I have 5,000, here's my 1,000. I have, they would fill out their tax returns. That's what they would do. They would come in and, they'd fill out, this is what I got, and this is what I'm giving to the state. But eventually, because there was such an abundance, people didn't bother anymore. They were making so much money. They had so much grain. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine a system in America where people would make so much money, they wouldn't bother counting it. They would just take a chunk of it and give it to the government. Just don't bother me with a tax return. It's just too complicated. I don't want to deal with it. I'm making so much money, it doesn't matter to me anymore. I'm making so many millions of dollars. Here, take a couple hundred thousand. Here, take it. Right? It just doesn't mean anything anymore. That's what was happening. There was so much food coming in to the individual in their own homes that they didn't bother. They just said, okay, I'll just estimate. Okay, this is about a fifth. Here, government, take it. So the grain was coming into the government without having been counted. So that means the government, in order for the government to count it, it wouldn't be as simple as just adding the new number. They would first have to count it and add the new number. That's in the beginning. So you would bring 1,000, you'd bring 2,000, you'd bring 500, and then the government would just write down the numbers and add it up. But now they were coming in uncounted. So now the government itself had to count it. There was no manpower to do that, to count all the grain that's coming in from all over the place. So they stopped counting. So the way that he reads the verse, which is very interesting, if we look at it again, back on 230, the way he reads it is, Memtes 49, is, Ad ki chadal lispor, they stopped counting, the government stopped counting, ki ein mispor, for there was no number. Not that there was number to count it. It was coming in without a number. It was coming in uncounted. So the government stopped counting it because it was coming to the government without a number. It wasn't labeled. There was no number on it. So they just didn't bother. It was just too much. That's the way he reads it, which I think is a very creative way of doing it, and it's a very interesting way of reading it. Either way you say it, the point of this verse is there was so much, it just got out of hand. There was nothing. When we learned before there were going to be 7 years of plenty, it was plenty that no one had ever fathomed. It was an incredible deluge of grain in the land of Egypt. Something that had never happened before. No one had been prepared for it. And it was so much that people just stopped counting. It was just beyond anybody's wildest dreams.
Was that in the Chosid Yosef? Was that on Yaakov when that's in the time they were blessed?
Well, I don't know, because here it's meant to prepare them for the years of famine. So I don't know. I don't know if you would say it's the Schus of Yosef. I think the whole thing is the Schus of Yosef, the fact that he predicted it and he ends up rising to power because of it. Excuse me. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Shehakol Nivra.
Amen.
Pasuk Nun, verse 50. Uli Yosef yulad shnei vanim, and to Yosef were born two sons. B'terem tavo shnas ha'ra'av, before the years of the famine came. So two sons were born to him during the years of plenty. Asher yoldolo asnas bas potiphera kohenon, that asnas bore for him the daughter of Potiphera, the prince of On, or the priest of On. The Gemara makes an observation here that why does the pasuk tell us Yosef had two sons before the years of famine came? Why not say simply, Yosef had two sons during the years of plenty? Mm-hmm. What is the emphasis before the years of famine came? What does it sound like?
the emphasis on, you know, it's that if you're doing well off personally, and you feed, you can give, you know, rear children. And yet, vice versa, if you're in a famine, you don't.
Okay.
So, the famine had not yet set in.
Right, the famine had not yet set in. But why not say during the years of plenty? Why say the famine had not yet set in? So the Gemara tells us, based on this verse, really almost exactly what Herman said.
Yeah, but it's emphasizing, you know, that it emphasizes it more than saying it like you would have said.
Right, that's right. The emphasis is before the years of famine, which means not during the years of famine.
Right.
So the Gemara tells us, now remember that before the days of easy contraception like today, the having children and husbands and wives having a physical relationship are almost the same thing. So what the Gemara says is that from here we learn that husbands and wives should not be together during years of famine. It is inappropriate during a famine for that to take place. That's what the Gemara tells us. Intimacy should not take place during years of famine. That is derived from here. Yosef had his children prior to the years of famine, not during years of famine. Now, what's the point of that? Why does the Gemara discuss it? What is the lesson over here? And what are we meant to learn from here? The context of the Gemara is, the Gemara says, let's say it's a time of pain or suffering. It's a time of famine. Famine is a time of suffering. People suffer during a famine. People go hungry, and people get sick, people die. A famine is a very bad time. It's a time of suffering. What happens if there's a famine, and there is one particular family where they are blessed to have plenty of food? They have plenty, for whatever reason, either because they are on the upper echelons of government, or because they're very, very wealthy, or because they happen to have some in with the black market, or some way that they're able to save themselves, which is not wrong. If there is a family that is able to keep themselves from starving, there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody's entitled to try to survive during a famine. But
I think the Gethanemel is you're trying to say, in spite of your wealth, you suffer with the community.
That's correct. That's exactly what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, if a person avoids the suffering of the community, they themselves are not suffering, and they turn their backs on the suffering of the community, and they don't suffer with the community, they will not see the salvation of the community. Okay, Ellen Melton, an example. Good. A person who says, I'll take care of myself, and then does not worry about everybody else, it's more than worry about everybody else, it experiences the pain with them. The appropriate thing to do is, if everybody else is suffering, and I'm not, the appropriate thing to do is for me to impose a self-afflicted suffering in order to feel what everybody else is feeling. Because it's really impossible for a human being to really feel what everybody else is going through if they themselves have nothing to do with it. If everybody else is in pain, and I'm perfectly fine, everything's great with me, I'm not really going to understand what's going on. It is appropriate for me to experience some suffering. It doesn't mean I have to throw all my food out, but it means that in some way or other, I should minimize how much I eat, because I have to feel the hunger pangs. Everybody else is starving, I've got to feel the hunger as well. That's the appropriate thing to do. If everybody else is suffering, then the person who was spared, thankfully, from the real suffering, has to experience some suffering as well. It's the correct thing to do, to join in with everybody else in their suffering. And if somebody doesn't do that, the Gemara says, then they will not see the salvation of the community. If a person, though, does join in with the suffering of the community, they will merit to see the salvation of the community. That's the appropriate thing to do. So what the Gemara says, therefore, is you know that when people are suffering, when there's real starvation going on, people are suffering, then there is no room for intimacy. The people themselves who are suffering, they're not going to be intimate. They won't have the strength. They won't have the people are much too nervous, concerned, upset, hungry, etc. Then normally under those conditions, people just don't do it. They just don't act that way. They can't. They can't. They physically can't be involved with each other in that way. That's normal. But now you have a family, a couple, that they have plenty of food. So they're doing fine. So they would naturally be intimate. Says the Gemara, no, they shouldn't. Because you have to join in with the suffering of everybody else. If everybody else is not in a position to be that way because they are suffering, then you shouldn't be either. And that's what the Gemara is saying over here. Yosef had plenty of food during the years of famine as well as the years of plenty. Yosef didn't lack food the entire time. Yosef was in the way upper echelons of government. He wasn't going to starve. He had nothing to worry about. As much as everybody else, we'll see later, the Egyptians had to buy their food from Yosef. Even though there was food in Egypt, but they had to buy it and they were nervous. Where's my next meal coming from? Yosef wasn't worried about where his next meal was coming from. Yosef was set. He wasn't suffering. But he had to join in with the suffering of everybody else. And you see from here, interestingly, that it wasn't his fellow Jews. It was Egyptians. But it doesn't matter. The country he was living in was suffering. Therefore, he and his wife had to join in with that suffering. And therefore, they were not intimate the entire time of the famine. And that's what the Gemara learns from here, based on this verse. Yeah?
It would also mean that wealth that you would use for family, you give to them?
Well, that's an extension of this, that obviously once you feel their pain, you're going to try to help as much as possible. But sometimes there's nothing that can be done. Sometimes there just isn't any food. Sometimes you just can't help. And sometimes, and certainly, one family is not going to be able to save everybody. Right. There's only so much you can do. But, nevertheless, one should try to experience the suffering. The relevance of this is, so we know, of course, during the horrible years of World War II, it would have been appropriate. None of us were, at least not old enough to really be involved in this way at that time, but it would have been appropriate for anybody living in America, any Jews living in America at that time, to experience some of the suffering of what was going on with our brethren in Europe, and to take upon ourselves here some degree of suffering because of what was going on there. More practically for us today, there are times when our brothers and sisters in other places on the globe experience significant suffering. We're not talking about an individual suffering. Individual suffering is bad, but this doesn't apply when it's an individual. This is talking about where there is a community that is suffering, it is appropriate for us to suffer with them. So particularly, let's say, unfortunately, when our brothers and sisters in Israel have had significant trouble, it is appropriate for us to accept upon ourselves some degree of suffering. And this happened during the first Gulf War. During the first Gulf War in the early 90s, at that time, I was single. I was in yeshiva at the time in Neri Yisrael in Baltimore, and my group of friends, we went to our Rosh Yeshiva of Blessed Memory, Rabbi Weinberg, and we asked him, "How do we react to what is going on?" There were Scud missiles flying through the air. At that time, we didn't know that it was going to be a miraculous salvation for our brothers and sisters, that almost no one would be killed from the missiles. Only one person was killed from the 39 Scud missiles that were shot into Eretz Yisrael, which was an incredible thing. I mean, they were falling in populated areas and people were saved. There were tremendous physical destruction of buildings. There was monetary destruction, but people survived. It was an incredible thing. But we didn't know that at the time. All we knew was that there were just missiles being shot into Israel and the population was in danger. So we asked our Rosh Yeshiva, how do we react to such a thing? So he told us, you have to do two things. He said, you need to improve in a particular area. So it was a group of us. He said the group should get together and think of something that you want to work on together, that you will work together on this particular item. He said it should have to do with, he told us at that time, it should have to do with how we speak. He didn't say that it has to be, for instance, not speaking Lashon Hara, which is a very common thing to do, but he just said it should be having to do with speech, with the power of speech. And he said that we should work on it together, meaning that we should accept upon ourselves that each of us would be willing to accept criticism from the other, that I would be, if I accept upon myself that if I'm caught doing the wrong thing and my friend comes over to me and says, you know, wags his finger at me, I'll say fine, and I won't get angry at the fact that he's criticizing me, like, who are you to criticize me? No, we're going to accept that we will be criticized together, all of us, and we can all wag our fingers at each other. We can all make sure to keep each other honest. That was one thing to improve in one area. But then he told us, but another thing you all have to do, and he said this should be done on an individual basis, each one of you accepting it on yourselves individually, you have to refrain from something pleasurable. Everybody has to take one thing that they normally do and refrain from it until the end of the tzara, till the end of the problem. I remember at the time, this is back in the early 90s, at that time, Baltimore had recently been blessed with two Dunkin' Donuts that had gotten a hechsher, kosher Dunkin' Donuts, and that is what I refrained from during the time. During the first Gulf War, I accepted upon myself not to indulge in anything from Dunkin' Donuts during that time. That was my thing at that time. Thankfully, it only lasted a few weeks. The war was over, and I was able to. But that was then. But that's the idea. That's exactly what's being said over here. When the community is suffering, it's not correct for those who are thankfully spared from the suffering to pretend that there's nothing going on. That's wrong. Everybody has to somehow feel the suffering. Now, I didn't take needles and start, you know, poking myself. I didn't do that. But to refrain from something pleasurable. That's the correct thing to do. And that's what we learn here from Yosef, that he refrained during the years of famine. Yes?
Why do you think that Rabbi Mosher picked speech?
That I don't know. I don't know why. That's I've thought about that many, many times, but I don't know the answer.
In regards to the children taking the conservative approach, just because you're well off today doesn't mean you're going to be well off tomorrow. If everything around you is crumbling and you're worried about raising kids because of the economics, that would be the conservative approach to take also.
You mean to not...
not to have relationships, not to have children, right in the middle of a depression, even if you are, if one is doing well.
Right, that's correct. But, I'm sorry.
Just from a non-spiritual point of view.
No, that's correct. Excuse me. You're right. But the point that the Gemara focuses on is not the children as much as the intimacy. That's the issue the Gemara is focusing on. And as I said at the outset, in those days, the intimacy and the children would go hand in hand. It wasn't, contraception was not as easily obtainable as it is today. And it was almost hand in hand. If there was going to be intimacy, there were going to be children.
So that's more of a pleasurable thing?
Or? That's what the Gemara is focusing on that, on the indulgence. Okay. That's what the Gemara is focusing on. But at any rate, he did have two sons over this seven-year period before the famine began. The pasuk continues, Nun Aleph 51, Vayikra Yosef es Shem HaBechor Menashe, and Yosef called the name of his oldest son, Menashe, Kinashani Elokim Eskolamoli Ve'ez Kobes Avi. For God has, now Nashani literally means to forget. How do they say it here? Yeah. God has made me forget all my hardship and all of my father's household. It means the hardship of my father's household as well. It's made me forget all of my hardship and all of the hardship of my father's household. This means Hashem has provided me to take care of my hardship and the hardship of my father's household. He means in the future, because this was during the years of plenty. He's saying that now God has provided for me that in the future when the hardship begins, I will be okay and so will the house of my father, my father's house. Yosef understands that these years of plenty and then the years of famine are going to eventually bring his family down to Egypt. He understands that's what's going to happen, and he understands that Hashem has provided for him now and for his entire family, his extended family, which is in fact what happens. So he called his name Menashe, which literally means to forget. Isn't that an interesting thing, to name a kid forget? Right? But it means here to forget the hardship. That's the context. The ace, Shema Sheni Kara Ephraim, and the name of the second one he called Ephraim. Why Ephraim? Ki Frani Elokim, for God has made me fruitful, the Eretz Anyi, in the land of my affliction. Here in Egypt, Yosef had gone through very, very hard times in the previous 13 years, being first a slave and then a prisoner, and finally he has risen to prominence, and so God has made him fruitful in this land of his affliction. And so he names him Ephraim. Yeah. Yeah.
The verse 51 where he says, and forget all the hardship of my father's household.
Yeah.
It seems that that's related to my hardship. That may, couldn't it mean that my father is suffering so much because I'm gone?
But then how did he forget it? That's still going on.
It says in the bottom part that it allowed him to forget the hardship his brothers had inflicted on him in his paternal home.
Okay, that would be saying that in the current, that would be saying currently, Hashem has given me the ability to forget all the hardships that I went through in the past. That's another way to look at it. But some of the commentaries say it's referring to the future. He has given me the ability to, that we will forget the hardships that are going to come up later.
It goes on with that, part of the divine master plan.
Right, right. Now these two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, are very important. These two sons, they are a lesson which we're going to follow throughout the Chumash, now that they are born. It's important to remember that Menashe is the older one, and Ephraim is the younger one. We know that later on in Parshas Vayechi, with Yaakov giving the blessing, he's going to do the famous switching of the hands, and give the better blessing, or the more important blessing, to Ephraim, the younger brother, rather than Menashe, the older brother. Why this is going to happen, we're going to try to follow as we go through the Chumash. And what their reaction is also very, very important. Remember that the blessing that a Jewish father gives his sons on Friday night is they should be like Ephraim and Menashe. Yisimcha alakim ke Ephraim v'chi Menashe. Where you give to your daughters that they should be like Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, like the matriarchs. We don't say that our sons should be like Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Rather, we say they should be like Ephraim and Menashe, which is very striking. Why pick Ephraim and Menashe over Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? So this is something which we're going to follow throughout the Chumash. We're going to actually discuss it more when we get to Parshas Vayechi, but this is where they are born, and we're going to see as we go through where they appear and try to see how eventually they become the subject of our blessing. Now we fast forward. Now we're going to move very quickly through the Psukim, because the Torah essentially has set it up, and now we're ready for the brothers. That we've had this whole interlude with Yosef, following his descent to Egypt, and now his ascent to power, and now the scene has been set with Yosef setting up everything for the years of famine. But now that we're ready for that, there's nothing to talk about. Now we're going to move ahead very quickly to bring the brothers down to Egypt, which is what it's all about over here. So Pasuk Nun Gimel 53. Vatichlena sheva shnei hasava asher haya beretz Mitzrayim. And the 7 years of plenty that were in the land of Egypt finally came to an end. They ended. If I'm living at that time, I could just see, just dreading those years to end. You know, it takes away the pleasure of something when you know it's going to be followed by pain. Right? It's great now, but you know it's going to end. It's really a terrible feeling. You don't want it to end. But you know you got 7 years and that's it. It's like a vacation. Right? Isn't vacation terrible? You're on vacation, you're waiting for vacation, waiting for vacation. Vacation comes, and all you can do is think about it. It's just another few weeks and I'm back. You know, another week and I'm back. Another couple of days and I'm back. And it ruins all vacation. Right, teachers can really appreciate that. Right? Okay.
Rabbi, do the people know? Do the Egyptian people know about the?
Yeah, it was predicted by Yosef.
Yeah, but I mean, could be just the king
knowledge. I don't think so. I think it became public knowledge. Okay. I think it was well known.
There was a whole organization for the heck to know.
Yeah, right.
Well, it was a decree of the king, so they had to bring their grain in, but okay. Vatechilena Shema Shnei Hara'av Lavo, and the 7 years of famine began to come. Kasha Amar Yosef, as Yosef said, Vayhi Ra'av B'chol Ha'aratzos, and there was famine in all the lands, which means the known lands of the time. There was famine. It wasn't just in Egypt. There was famine in Canaan. There was famine all over the place. It was a very bad time. There was famine all over the place. But U'v'chol Eretz Mitzrayim Hayalachem, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. Wherever all the other countries were had nothing to eat, Egypt had bread. Because of Yosef, of course. Vatir'av kol Eretz Mitzrayim, all the land of Egypt were hungry. Now this is difficult. We just said that there was bread. And now it says they were all hungry. They were famished. Vayitzak ha'am el paro lalochem, and the nation cried out to Paro for bread. Vayomer Paro, Paro said, l'chol Mitzrayim, to all of Egypt, l'chu el Yosef, go to Yosef. Asher yomar lachem ta'asu, whatever he tells you, do. Now, this is a difficult pasuk. What happened over here? We just said that there was famine in all the lands, but in Egypt there was bread. Okay, fine. The entire land of Egypt was famished. They were hungry. But there was bread. Why should they be hungry? So apparently there was bread, but they couldn't get their hands on the bread. That's what it seems, right? So they cry out to Paro for bread. Give us bread. Okay, so apparently the government was hoarding the bread. That's what it seems like the pasuk is saying. Vayomer Paro lechol Mitzrayim. So Paro said to all of Egypt, go to Yosef. Don't talk to me. He's in charge. I put him in charge of the whole operation. It's his baby. You want to deal with this whole problem? Go to Yosef. Asher yomar lachem ta'asu. Whatever he tells you, do. That's a funny statement. If I were writing the Torah, I would have said that go to Yosef and get bread from him. What do you mean, whatever he tells you, do? That sounds like there was something that Yosef was telling them to do that they didn't want to do. He was telling them do something, but they weren't interested in doing what he said to do. So they came to Paro and they said, give us bread. And he said, go to Yosef. Whatever he tells you to do, do. You see, the government had bread. And the bread was for the people. It was for the people. They were going to get their bread. But Yosef had put a condition on the bread. And they didn't like the condition. So they went to Paro instead of Yosef. They tried to go above his head. And they went to Paro and they said, we want bread. And Paro said, go back to Yosef. Whatever he tells you to do, I can't do anything about it. So what is this exchange? What's happening over here? The Gemara tells us, they all knew that the 7 years of famine were coming. So when they were taking off 20% and giving it to the government, they were also hoarding their own grain. Wouldn't you? If you knew for a fact that here you have 7 years of plenty, if you knew for a fact that all of your stocks and your assets, which were multiplying in the double digits over the past number of years, if you knew that in 2008 everything was going to drop, so you would have put it all away and taken off a little bit each time and put it away for yourself to protect yourself for the time when it was going to drop. So if they got these years of plenty, way more than they need, even after giving 20% to the government, it still was way more than they needed. So, naturally, everybody would have their own private stockpile that they would put away for the years of famine, which is what they did. Comes the years of famine, all the hoarded food in Egypt spoiled, except for Yosef's. It all spoiled, except for Yosef's. No one had grain. Hashem here is intervening, because Hashem's plan is for everybody to be dependent on Yosef. Yosef is going to run the show, whether they like it or not. And they can plan all they want. A mensch tracht und Gott macht, right? A person can plan all he wants, but God is going to do what he wants to do. And that's what's happening over here. So they put away food, but it all spoiled. So they came to Yosef. And they said, we need food. Yosef said, okay, you got to pay. So they said, fine, here's money. They all came with their money. They said, you know what? There's another condition. All of you, at least the men, got to get circumcised. And they said, what? They said, no way. He said, fine, no food. That was Yosef's condition. So they went to Paro. And they said to Paro, we need bread. So he said, well, what about Yosef? So he said, you know what he wants us to do? So he said, okay, fine. Didn't you put away bread for yourselves? Didn't you know the 7 years of famine were coming? Didn't you put away bread for yourselves? So they said, we did. We all put away bread. But it all spoiled. So he said to them, if Yosef decreed that your bread should spoil, and it got spoiled, and he's thinking, this is Yosef at work, not God, Yosef. If Yosef has the power to put a spell on your grain and poison your grain and it all dies, if he's able to do that, maybe he'll make a spell, maybe he'll decree that we should all die and we're all going to die. This man is far too powerful to be trifled with. Don't mess with Yosef. If he's able to make all your grain spoil, who knows what he can do to us? Whatever he tells you to do, go do it. And now it became a decree of Paro to do whatever Yosef says. See, until now, he gave Yosef sweeping power, but within the confines of the bread. Now, Paro is giving Yosef an additional level of power. Whatever he says, do. Because now, Paro is scared. Until now, Paro was enthralled with Yosef, that Yosef had given Paro all of this power, the power to withstand the famine and become so powerful economically and militarily. But now there's fear. Now Yosef seems to be this very, very dangerous person. So Paro is scared and he commands his subjects, do whatever he says because I don't want him destroying all of us. Yep.
But isn't also by circumcising all the Egyptians, you cut down the number of children and the demand for food?
Well, I don't know if they were having children at this point because they didn't have any food.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, that's one way to cut down on the population.
Why would they cut down children? What is that going to do? Why is it
you don't have sex after you're
that's a temporary. It is going to be a temporary thing. That there'll be a period of time where there will be a delay. Yeah.
Is there anything that would imply that maybe they're wanting these people to believe in the God that?
Okay. So the question is, why does Yosef want them to get circumcised? What is that all about? I mean, there's no command that the Egyptians have to be circumcised. Circumcision was given as a mitzvah to Abraham and his descendants. That's all. Egypt certainly is not one of his descendants. And even Yishmael, really, even though he himself had to be circumcised, his children do not have to be circumcised, even though they do. We know the Arabs do it. But it is not a requirement in the Torah that the Arabs be circumcised. And so the why is Yosef imposing this on the non-Jews? We don't do that. We don't make non-Jews keep commandments that were given only to Jews. It's not a requirement. They have seven laws. They have to keep them, and that's it. So why is he imposing circumcision on the Egyptians? So there are several approaches to this. I'm going to give you right now what I think is the simplest approach, at least the most straightforward approach. Later on, in very short order, Yosef's brothers are going to be coming down to Egypt. And Yosef knows that there is a decree from the Bris Ben Abasarim, the covenant between the halves that Hashem had with Abraham, that the Jewish people are going to be strangers in a land not their own. And we're going to be foreigners. And it appears that Hashem didn't say specifically it's going to be Egypt, but Yosef sees the writing on the wall. It's going to be Egypt. He sees what's happening over here. This is going to be the process of bringing the Jewish people down to Egypt, where they will be there until the Exodus. We're going to be strangers in a land not our own. Now, being a stranger, being a foreigner, is tough. it's a tough thing to do. Some of you here have been foreigners or are foreigners, and it's a tough thing. The language barrier is very hard. Culturally, there's a barrier. It's tough being a foreigner. It's very, very difficult. We Jews, we've always been foreigners. When our ancestors came to America, whether each of us around the table here, whether it was us ourselves, whether it was our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, whatever it is that our families came over, but they were foreigners when they came over, and that time is tough. It's always tough. English is a second language. It's not easy. The more that you stand out, the more that you appear different, the tougher it is. Yosef, as we're going to see later, is going to take steps to try to minimize his brothers and his descendants' sense of being foreigners. One of the things he's going to do, which we're going to see much later, is he's going to move people around, Egyptians. He's going to take Egyptians from one city and move them to another city. He's going to take the people from Atlanta, move them to Savannah. Take the people from Savannah, move them to Macon. Take the people from Macon, move them to Montgomery, Alabama. Take the people from Montgomery. He mixed everybody up. Why did he do that? As we're going to see, once he had power to do it, he did it. Why did he do it? Because he wanted to make it that everybody was out of their place. Everybody was foreign. Even if they were Egyptian, but they weren't on their home turf. Everybody felt a sense of an uneasiness of not being where they belong. He did that on purpose in order for his brothers not to feel so foreign. It seems to me that one of the reasons for the circumcision is this as well. Because one of the ways that Jewish men stand out in this way is circumcision. So you'll say, but it's a private thing. But it's not so private. Because yes, it's private in daily life, but there's bathing. And bathing is a public thing in their day. It's not bathing because there's no running water. We have running water, so bathing is a private thing you do in your own home. But when you don't have running water, there's bathhouses. You go to the bathhouse. I can't tell you how many of our ancestors felt shame going to a bathhouse with non-Jews who would ridicule us for being circumcised. It was a common thing. It was so common that it is brought in the Shulchan Aruch. It's brought in the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch that if a Jewish man is bathing, he should not cover himself up. He should not cover himself up when he's bathing. Meaning that one might think, well, it's modesty to cover oneself up when bathing. We're talking about all men bathing. Well, it was normal to bathe undressed. That's the way you bathe. And nobody covered themselves up. But it's the way they say it is, he shouldn't cover himself up. Why? Because if he covers himself up, it appears like he's embarrassed that he's circumcised. And he shouldn't be embarrassed. He should be proud of the fact that he did a mitzvah, or that his parents did a mitzvah for him when he was a child. And that's the appropriate thing to do. One should not be embarrassed to keep the Torah. But it was a real problem. We don't experience it today for two reasons. First of all, circumcision is so widespread in America, even non-Jews. You don't have to be Jewish to be circumcised. It's all over the place. But second of all, we bathe privately, so it doesn't come up. It rarely ever comes up. But in the days of non-running water, it was a very common thing, and it was a very shameful thing. So Yosef here ensures that the brothers will not have that shame. They're all going to be circumcised. That's another way that the brothers won't feel as foreign as they would otherwise.
Why is it shameful?
If everybody else is different, it's always shameful to be different. To be different is shameful. Doesn't matter whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, you ever read the Dr. Seuss book with the stars? My husband went through that book. They have stars, don't have stars. You know this book? Huh? You missed that one? Okay.
Would that have caused more assimilation than that suggestion?
Okay, so what about assimilation?
It was Monday morning quarterbacking 400 years going forward.
Okay. So Jay's bringing up a good point. In terms of assimilation, it would make it worse. Because the more that you take away those barriers, the more likely there'll be assimilation. And this is always a struggle. We Jews, how do you balance the the anti-Semitism versus assimilation. In Europe, in Eastern Europe at least, in Eastern Europe, assimilation was virtually nil. Why was it virtually nil? Because they hated our guts. There was such a strong animosity, there was such a barrier between Jew and non-Jew, assimilation was almost unheard of. There was, of course, but it wasn't anything to speak of because of the fact that there were such strong barriers between Jew and non-Jew. But that means there was anti-Semitism.
They wouldn't let us live with them.
Right.
They had to live in separate...
Right, ghettos. Right? Yeah, sure. So the ghetto is bad in terms of anti-Semitism, but it's good to prevent assimilation. But if you start breaking down the barriers, which is better for anti-Semitism, it takes away some of the anti-Semitism, but then you run the risk of assimilation. So you always have that struggle, and we've had this struggle throughout our exile. Most of the time, the struggle was anti-Semitism. That was most of the time. Today, the struggle is more assimilation. That's what we deal with more today than our ancestors had to deal with. And we prefer this because it's less painful. But it's still painful because people do assimilate. When that happens, it's painful. So there's different types of pain, different types of danger, and you're right. By breaking the barriers, the danger of assimilation becomes greater. And we know that when the Jews were finally taken out of Egypt so many years later, we know that 4/5 of the Jewish people did not leave. And we'll get to that later when we get to the plagues. And that's because they had assimilated. That's what happened. And they weren't interested in leaving Egypt. That was the issue.
Yes, they wanted to, but they couldn't.
They didn't want to leave Egypt. They liked it. They liked Egypt.
But also, Jews' religion was based on Goshen, which was to have some protection.
That's correct.
To protect them from assimilation.
Right. So we're going to see that there were barriers that were built, and that those barriers were to protect them from assimilation. Nevertheless, when you're in a country for 210 years, it happens. You know that's the problem, and that's right. And it is definitely if you're able to control the level of barrier, it's difficult to think of, well, how big should the barrier be? You don't want it too much, but you don't want it too little. And that's a very hard thing to gauge. Yeah?
The Jewish people, 4/5, stayed there because they liked it, or they died?
They died because they didn't want to leave.
Oh, so they did die.
Yeah, they died. But they didn't want, the reason why Hashem did not take them out is because they didn't want to leave. But we'll talk about that more in depth when we get to the Exodus, which is a while off.
A few million that left Egypt. So that meant that there were 12, 15 million?
Yeah, it's an incredible number. It's very hard to understand, very hard to swallow that. Let's leave that for when we get to it. That's a very tough thing. You're right. You're bringing up a very, very strong point. And we'll have to tackle that when we get there. But that's a tough one. Okay, so... Okay, so we are up to Pasuk Nun Vav 56. This is going to be easier to remember. It's only 1 week away. But let's try to remember that we have to Pasuk Nun Vav 56. And as I said, the next part of the story is going to be bringing the brothers down to Egypt. We're not quite finished this chapter. Almost finished it.